the back end, that profitability has really taken off, you know, in the 20 years I've seen it. Remember back when it first started, the target PVR was to try to hit 1,000, right? And that was the big number.
There's a secret profit weapon for dealerships across the nation, and this man has a front row view to where it's all headed. Today, I'm speaking with Todd Sands, Senior Vice President at CNA National, a leading provider of finance and insurance products for the automotive industry.
But before we dive into the show, this episode is brought to you by CDK Global. CDK Global has been empowering nearly 15,000 dealers with the tools and technology they need to build deeper relationships with customers. Their team is keenly aware of the state of dealership technology, and while many vendors promise seamless experiences between your CRM, DMS, digital retail, and fixed ops, most of these bolt-on solutions tend to break workflows and cause more harm than good. That is why CDK has launched a new dealership experience platform. This new integrated software consists of everything you need to operate a dealership efficiently while delivering an unparalleled experience to your customers. Basically, everything working together, not separate, one system to run your dealership as opposed to 10. CDK developed it with an outside-in approach, listening to dealers every step of the way. You can learn more about CDK's dealership experience platform by visiting cdkglobal.com/dxp or clicking the link in the show notes below. This episode is also brought to you by Upstart. Upstart partners with dealers to digitize and connect their online, in-store, and financing process to create the car buying experience today's customers expect. Backed by trusted OEMs, Upstart helps dealers sell more cars efficiently, speeding up processes to boost profits and enhance customer satisfaction. With integrated finance capabilities powered by AI technology, Upstart's connected platform enables consumers to shop from anywhere, then seamlessly transition in-store and complete the deal digitally, creating a hassle-free purchase path that benefits both dealers and buyers. For a brighter car buying future, visit upstart.com/dealers. That's upstart.com/dealers, or click the link in the show notes below. Lastly, this episode is also brought to you by CNA National. I'd like to thank CNA National for coming on as a guest and also supporting this podcast. First of all, I think the one thing that stuck out to me about you and your career at CNA is how long you've been there. Very rare to see that nowadays. I mean, over 2 decades. What gives, man? Like, are you just built differently? Like, what's going on over here?
Well, I'm naturally inclined. I'm a loyalist. When you look it down deep, and a lot of it has to come back to the culture of the organization. You know, when I started here, just the people I'm surrounded with on a daily basis, work hard, get the job done. But I've also watched the company grow over time. When I first started here, there were about 100 employees here in Scottsdale with our division. And now we're bumping up over 300 plus employees. And just to watch the organization grow and to see what we've been able to accomplish over all these years and to see some of the new people come into the organization. But, you know, I'm just a green pea, actually. When you look at my tenure at the company, there's a VP of our
state. Oh, I look.
Yeah.
I did some creeping. I looked through the page and everything. I saw there was a lady that just crossed like 40 years at the company. I'm like, whoa.
Yeah, she's on my team.
So there you go. I did my homework. So before we get in, we're going to get into some the details of F&I, VSCI, vehicle service contracts, warranties. I mean, there's a ton of discuss on that. And I've lately been doing more deep dives into this type of content, just offering, you know, a wider perspective for the audience. Before we even get into that, I'm curious to know how has, you know, the call it like back end and just automotive in general evolved since, you know, you've started in this industry. And I'm talking from the perspective of, you know, today we are the dealer, right, much more optimizing for an even split, call it at most, I would say an even split between front end profit, right, profit on the vehicle and back end profit on ancillary products. But what have you seen? How has that changed? I'm just curious to know from since you started in this industry, right, what have been like the biggest changes that you've seen happen there?
Man, well, you know, 20 plus years will give you a lot of answers to that. But, you know, really what you've seen is the entrepreneurs in our space, you know, continue to bring new products to market in relation to the F&I office and also on the front end for sales opportunities. But, you know, when I first started, everything was paper. So that's how long it goes back that there was no such thing as e-contract and everything was generated via paper rate charts and all that flew through those F&I offices. And then the culmination of the products came on. You know, you started with a basic extended warranty or extended service contract, and you had the gap offerings that were out there and some basic tire and wheel. And then all these additional bundle type products or ancillary products started to come to market. And, you know, the industry really, really took off with the array of offerings, right? You've got vehicle protection products from interior, exterior protection. So they really started to expand dramatically, creating more opportunities for the buyers to have more protection for their vehicles, you know, based on their needs and their wants. And at that rapid pace, what we've also seen is you mentioned the back end, right? You got the front end profit, the back end. That profitability is really taken off, you know, in the 20 years I've seen it. I remember back when I first started, the target PVR was to try to hit 1,000, right? And that was the big number. And now if you're hitting 1,000.
Wait, just to be clear, that was a target profit you're referring to on a vehicle or on ancillary products?
On PVR, per vehicle retail.
Correct. But are we talking about total? Or are we talking about front end, back end? What are we talking about?
Yeah, back end, total. Yeah. That was.
Oh, back end.
Yeah, yeah,
okay.
Yeah. So we're talking 15 years ago plus.
Yeah. So, and then what are you seeing today? Like, what are dealers targeting in back end profit?
Well, that's taken a turn over here the last few years, right? I mean, if you look back 2 years ago, 3 years ago, coming into COVID, when the demand was very high and the supply was low, I think those numbers were up significantly, right? And we were starting to see that backpedal just a little bit, but seeing ranges anywhere from 2,000 to 3,000 in a general PVR. You know, it depends on the size of the organization, the makeup of their lineup, you know, geographical components, but seems to be a good steady number. Seems to be a good target out there that is a number that people are eyeballing to say, you know, 2,000 PVR is an ideal number.
What's separating the 2,000 dealerships to the 3,000 dealerships?
There's a slippery slope on that one, but a number of things could be a component of that. You know, a lot of it comes down to the people that may have been there a long time, the training, the processes back end that are involved with the systems they may be using to bring them to start and finish. And it's also the way they're interacting with their customers and the needs. I mean, I think that the $3,000 PVR, as you see some of these vehicles now, MSRP is $65,000 plus, you're starting to see a higher demand for that protection and the need for some of these products in the F&I office based on what we're seeing.
Yeah, I actually haven't thought about that, right? With just vehicles costing more, higher percentage of someone's disposable monthly income, sort of makes sense. You're taking more risk. You're going to be more inclined to want protection. You know, I did see, I think I mentioned this on a previous podcast, but I did see that an article is stated, again, I want to say this was from CDK Global, about Gen Z being like incredibly risk averse in their purchase and just having a higher rate, attach rate on back-end products, which I just found fascinating because, you know, we really went from Gen Z's not going to buy cars to Gen Z buys cars. They do it in a dealership and they're buying more products for their cars. Like, it's quite the turn, huh?
Yeah, it's quite fascinating. So I remember seeing the same thing when they were talking about the Gen Z. They weren't going to be buying cars and going to be relying on Uber and Lyft and different means for transportation, and how that paradigm has changed. And now to see that same publication that they're buying more products and more interested in more protection products, it's quite fascinating to see that change and the correlation between the generation and others.
Correct. So what are you doing at CNA, right? What do you focus on?
The team here is really focused on, you know, the F&I product offerings, the training to the dealership staffs, and then really the customer service experience. You know, a big emphasis where we focus our align our strategy is just trying to make sure that customer experience all the way through is in a good place, so that CSI scores are at an acceptable level based on our performance here in Scottsdale with our claims administration. But also when we look at the customer, we've got a customer journey that starts with we've got a dealer customer, right, whose name's on the building. And then we've got the folks at the dealership level all the way through the different departments from F&I to sales to service that are our customers as well. And then the end user, the consumer. You know, it's very important that in these days with, you know, the social media, the better business ratings and reviews that are out there, that, you know, adhere to what the customer's expectations are. I mean, we were just, you know, you and I just talking a second ago about how the cost of vehicles have gone up so much. I mean, you get to a point where a customer's expectation is to have a contract that covers that says it's going to cover and make sure that their buying experience is faithful. Because ultimately you want that customer going back to the dealership, right? For additional work and for additional service work and buying a repeat vehicle from them and continuing the life cycle of the customer journey.
Yeah, I'm curious to know, based on your data, and you have lots of it, so we can, you know, hit this in several different ways, but do you see any major geographical differences in like rate of adoption for products based on where, you know, where you are in the country, right? Like, give us some of that insider insight to where do you see nuances in terms of actual customer behavior? I asked you earlier about the, you know, what separates the 3,000 dealership from the 2,000. You mentioned process, which of course I totally agree with, but I'm curious to know like anything else that you're seeing there.
Well, you definitely see a demographic split. So I'll give you a couple examples. When you look at metro cities, so you mentioned what Philadelphia, right? And here we're in Phoenix Metro. You look in Chicago Metro, Atlanta, New York, Dallas, and you can go into some of those larger metro markets. You've got a far larger customer base, a lot more competition, right? At the retail level, the dealers competing with each other significantly. You've got some of the, you know, some of the publics, a lot of the privates. And so what you'll tend to see is a different metric there on the performance. You've got a lot of folks that have been in the business a long time. And then you get into maybe more of the surrounding rural areas, right? And you get into some of more of the small private mom and pop dealership areas. You know, the customer experience across the board is very important to all of them. But you start to see a little bit of maybe a transition and change as it relates to the PBR, maybe, and also the products that they're promoting and selling through their F&I office. Because they all change, right? They've got options on what they want to sell at the dealership, from vehicle service contracts to GAB, all the way down into those ancillary product offerings, from the bundles, the painless dent repair, the interior, exterior. So there's a myriad of products that can be offered, and based on the makeup of the makes that they're selling as well. So there's a number of factors that you'll see that tie into the ultimate performance at the dealership level.
Talk to us about products, right? Are there up and coming products right now? Are there products that are maybe, you know, going out of style? What are you seeing on that end?
The product mix out there is constantly changing, evolving. You know, there's always someone that's on the front end that is a leader in finding that new product out there. And I don't want to say widgets. It's not a widget. I mean, there's every product that's brought to market by the folks that operate in this space, they all bring value to the consumer. So as you look into the product offerings, you've got a lot of the traditional products, extended service contracts or vehicle service contracts. You've got, you know, the GAP, you've got these tire and wheel products. And then you start to see some different products out there. Like you're seeing Etch for catalytic converters that you're seeing out there. It has popped up in the last, you know.
Can you explain that to anyone that's not familiar with this? Can you just explain how this works?
Well, with the significant theft rate of the catalytic converters that has been taking place throughout the country, and that being utilized, you know, there was an opportunity to take an Etch type product, right, and stencil it on the catalytic converter and create a warranty product or insurance protection for that theft that was happening. And there was some heavy dominance in different areas of the country, but ultimately, it became an opportunity where there was value to the consumer, right? To have that protection in light of the potential theft of a catalytic converter.
Yeah, I can't tell you how many cats I've replaced in my time as a dealer. Like I literally can't even count. It's just absolutely absurd.
And this goes back to the last few years. You're seeing that?
I mean, there was definitely a massive uptick in the last couple of years, for sure. But just thinking back to like the amount of times, you know what vehicles were notorious for getting their cats stolen? Do you know what I'm thinking?
I'm not there with
the
you.
Mitsubishi Outlander.
Ah.
The Outlanders, man, these things, because here's why, right? They were tall enough. They had like a very easy cat to steal, right? So they were tall enough to where people could like roll right under them or, you know, slide underneath. And these things were like super easy to steal. So I'm telling you, like, the amount of times that I woke up in the morning and I get a text like, hey, Outlander cats are stolen. It got to the point where we had to take all of our Outlanders, and we had lots of them. We were selling lots of them. We had to park them completely off site in a gated lot. And it was still advertised online just so that like we wouldn't leave them on a lot anymore. I mean, to that extent, like we couldn't do it because the Outlander is notorious for getting their cat stolen. I don't know with the latest models, if anything has changed, but man, we spent a lot of money on that. But anyways, Etch, again, like, you know, fascinating product. And it's funny how, like, you know, you can come up with insurance for almost anything.
Yeah, you absolutely can. And that's the beauty of our business. And, you know, with the frontiers that are out there, you're always going to have something new coming to market. And, you know, traditionally you just take a look, and we tend to be fairly conservative in our approach and just look at for best in class products. And we don't necessarily go after the widgets that may be, you know, the hot ticket for a period of time. We look at just a longer term view, you know, stability and making sure that the performance standards are there, more the table stakes type products. But again, it's just a matter of what those dealers and producers out there are really looking for to complement their lineup of product offerings. And like you said, with the Mitsus, what they're seeing with the theft rate on the converters.
This episode is brought to you by my very own Car Dealership Guy industry job board. CDGjobs.com, my industry job board connecting the best talent in automotive with the best companies, will remain absolutely free for CDG listeners to post and fill available roles at their companies. This free job board is for anyone in automotive, vendors, dealers, lenders, manufacturers, auto tech, everyone. Already, over 100 companies have posted open positions, including Lithia Motors, Recurrent, Credit Acceptance, Viros Credit, Cars Commerce, Shift Digital, Plug, Full Path, Westlake, Trade Pending. You get the point. The best part is that when these companies hire through cdgjobs.com, they are hiring the most informed candidates in the marketplace. So don't hesitate. You can add your open roles today by visiting cdgjobs.com or clicking the link in the show notes below. That's cdgjobs.com. All right, Todd. So I want to shift topics. Tell me a little bit about reinsurance. You know, if you could just provide like a super brief overview, because I'm going to assume most people listening are familiar or use it. But I really want to focus on how, and if any way, you see it evolving right now. Right. So let's just start us off with like a super brief overview. State of reinsurance within dealerships.
Yeah, sure. I mean, look, reinsurance is something that spun off from the insurance industry into our space. And in the automotive space, it was geared up back in the 70s when you had credit life, A&H, disability, and then the onset of extended warranties came into the market and took off at a rapid pace. But you know, there have been multiple types of reinsurance structures that are out there. And not all of it is reinsurance. I mean, there's dealer-owned warranty companies, there's a retrospective program. So there's a myriad of ways for, you know, the dealers to get involved with this. But ultimately, what's happening is they're participating in the back-end insurance profitability, right? There's a reinsurance, it's just a transfer of risk from one insurer to another. And so when that takes place, there becomes a favorable position for that owner-operator to participate in that back end. And what you've seen is over the course of, you know, 20 plus years, at least that I've witnessed, is you've seen changes and slight tweaks to the programs that are out there, whether it's where they're located, which would be like a domicile. Obviously, you've got the tax regs that are constantly changing, right? Based on the U.S. Treasury and the IRS on how they view the different structures and what rulings they may come out with or that they might have proposed. And then it ties to the overall performance of the investment markets. So as the stock market goes, you know, a big part of the insurance market is tied to the yield, right, on your investments as well. So you've got the combination of all those taking place to favor, you know, getting some of the insurance proceeds to those dealer owner operators and their partners at the dealership and ownership level.
Yeah. So classic case of like vertical integration where, you know, a dealer, you're obviously selling tons of warranties. Why not participate in that underwriting profit or loss, of course, if it doesn't work out? But tell me, so there's a couple quick questions here, right? Like I'm familiar with one type, you know, I've experience with this, but what are the different types of reinsurance in the market today? You mentioned like dealer owned warranty company. So can you just break that down for us?
Yeah, absolutely. So you're going to get into a couple different basic structures, high level. So first one would be like a dealer owned warranty company. So dealer would ultimately set up their own obligor entity, which is the company that's obligated behind the scenes to perform. They file the product at the state level, and then they participate with their product in that company and that structure over a period of time with, you know, certain tax benefits, certain investment income returns or investment returns. And then ultimately at the end of the rainbows, when these contracts earn out, right, and mature, you've got claims being charged against it. Whatever's left goes into some form of surplus or what's referred to as like an underwriting profit. So that would be one structure that is prevalent out there. And then you have another, which would be considered a producer-owned reinsurance company, sometimes referred to as a U.S. domiciled. It's like an 831B reinsurance company traditionally. where it's a smaller, it's got a premium cap to it, where you can only write so much annual written premium, net written premium, but it gives the dealer the opportunity to participate in all F&I products, right? It's just not extended service contracts. It's the products that are available to go into that company. And, you know, it's, I like to correlate it to, you start up, but you're starting an insurance business is what you're doing. You're starting a small insurance company that is set up and, you know, traditionally, there's a favorable domicile. There's multiple domiciles that are available for the dealers to use in that structure.
Does that matter, Todd? Does that matter? Like where these, right? Again, so you're a dealer. You're selling all these warranties. Why not be an insurer as well? Because these things are clearly very profitable. So you set up this company. Now, when you say domicile, right, where the company is actually domiciled, like, does that actually matter where someone domiciles these reinsurance companies?
It does. I mean, for example, if you want to do something here in Arizona, the cost to domicile a company, you know, back in the 70s and 80s, Arizona was a hotbed for these types of structures. But as the cost goes up, right, the operating costs, the annual costs, the licensing for the company, as those have gone up, other domiciles historically have come into play. There, at one point, there was still possibly out there Nevis. You've got the Turks and Caicos, and then you've got some other domiciles here in the U.S. that are being used. And the primary basis there is from a cost perspective. You know, keep the expense, annual operating expenses, to minimize those in order for the company to operate efficiently and at the maximum profitability. And that's why these domiciles really come into play, because, again, you can go here in Arizona and other states, but you can have some significant cost, startup costs to get them going and ongoing operating costs. So a big part of that is cost structure.
What are you seeing as like the average loss ratio nowadays on these companies? And I'm also curious to know if like it's rising, declining, if you're seeing any trends there.
Absolutely. I've seen a trend, an uptick in the last, say, go on about last 18 months or so, because we've seen as an industry, gosh, we've seen parts and labor escalate significantly in the course of, you know, really mid-22 through 23. I mean, there's been a number of publications as of late and different editorials, industry editorials, that have alluded to that with escalations in the labor rates, right? Part of that's tied back into retaining good techs. So you've seen labor rates go up significantly. Some of it has been driven at the state level with different legislation on the labor rate side. But the main thing is the parts. The reimbursement on that. I mean, a traditional RO in our space is probably, you're looking at maybe 50-50 parts to labor, sometimes 60-40. But when you look at what's going on with the parts pricing, I mean, I'll give you an example. Pre-COVID, basic or traditional engine assembly was sitting around $4,600, right? Just for the total claim parts and labor. And you look at that in 23, it's jumped up to $7,900. So you've seen some significant increase.
So that's an engine assembly at, like, give us a little bit more context. So you're turned to like just average between all franchise and independent dealerships.
Yeah, that's a number that's just a combined based on a general domestic lineup. So take a,
and we're talking about a used engine.
Well, at this point, you know, the procurement of parts, you know, is pretty much the same because of some of the supply challenges that are out there. So whether it's used, but, you know, whether it's like kind of quality used or even a reman, traditionally it's coming in at that point.
Wow. So from 4,600 to 7,900, that's how much the average cost of an engine assembly has gone up in the US.
Yeah. And that was just a general number that I grabbed. I was looking at in relation to some inflationary pressures. What's that?
I said that's definitely outpaced inflation.
Yeah, and I think that's the challenge that as the industry we're going to be facing here in the next few years is no one. If you would have gone back and we had this conversation in late 21 and we were talking about what we would foresee to be the downstream effects of COVID and the supply and all things that were happening, I don't think either one of us would have said, yeah, we're going to see parts and labor jump by anywhere from 20% to 30%. Over the course of a year period of time. I mean, if we would have all known that, we all would have hedged against that with, you know, premium adjustments to the pricing of the policies to hedge against that for the well-being of the dealer's back end. So we've seen a rise in the loss ratio. We look at the L12 and it's been ticking up, you know, it depends on the location.
What do you look at? The what? What is that?
We look at a 12-month rolling to see this kind of the trends on a year-over-year basis to look at it, to forecast and hedge against it.
Mm-hmm. What are the specific changes when you said you're seeing a rise? Like, what does specifically the rise look like?
So we're seeing across the industry, we're seeing a change in, you know, some of it is associated with the used cars. As an example, you notice over the last few years, the used cars have aged a little bit in the dealer's inventory. They've got a little bit more higher mileage. So we're seeing an older used car, higher mileage used cars coming in with the protection, which tends to get into a higher risk area based on the condition of that vehicle. And you're starting to see some of the newer cars come back in the market with the sales cycle, which is created, you know, some of that new business coming into its life cycle. But across the board, you'll see a change in the loss performance all the way down at the make and model level. Some of the makes perform a little bit better than others, but you do have the demographic component of it, you know, location, geographic. I mean, just recently we had a claim get called in. It wasn't at one of our online or issuing customers, but it was considered just a transient repair. And to just give you an idea, the labor rate that was being used was over $300 an hour that was being called. Yeah. So, you know, at some point it's going to need to give a little bit in relation to what's happening with the general consumer base out there, right? I mean, you got some costs that are going to start outrunning the disposable income that's available to these consumers to afford some of these repairs if they don't have the protection products.
And how are you, as you know, a warranty company, how are you dealing with this, right? When you see $300 labor rate, clearly I'm going to assume you have a cap somewhere in between there. Like, how are you navigating through that?
And there's a lot of levers there that we can work through on our end. I mean, we do have the actuaries, right? Those are the folks that price all this stuff, the folks in the back end that look at, you know, predictive what's coming in the future. So we'll do an annual price adjustment or premium adjustment based on where it's needed and warranted based on what we've seen with the trends. So, you know, that's a part of it. But one of the things that we're very fortunate is that we've got our entire claim staff here. They're made up of all ex-automotive, you know, fixed ops personnel, service advisors, service managers, service riders. So we've got some eyes and ears on the back end here that can kind of look through the call and get a sense for, is there a multiple line item claim that is really needed here? And so they'll be able to kind of triage that up front. But then we've got a lot of systems on the back end now that we've introduced on streamlining the processes and then trying to get more predictive in what's coming with the data and the analytics, because that's, you know, the future state of where this business is going to go with the predictive and, you know, what I don't want to say AI, but, you know, that's potentially a component of what's going to be happening here to get smarter with the millions of data records that we have to really glean that information and predict what's going to happen with these certain makes and models short-term and long-term on the performance side.
Mm-hmm. So speaking of predictive and what's going to happen, obviously we've seen the rise of electric vehicles over the last couple of years and the market share has grown. We're going through a bit of a cooling period now, which we know, but needless to say, there's more EVs on the streets. I'm talking to used car dealers who are, you know, in more of the subprime space who are feasting on the used EVs right now, just given the tax credit, which sort of serves as a down payment for the consumer, can get applied directly to the vehicle. So anyways, no doubt about it that we're seeing more EVs on the roads. We also know that they've been selling very, very slowly on the new side, and that's been a struggle for more dealers. I'm curious to know from you, how are you approaching EVs from an insurance perspective, right? Like, what is different and what are you building to anticipate a future where the reality is there's going to be more EVs on the road? How are you navigating through that?
We started that journey well over 2 years ago. We went out and we entered into a relationship with a company that actually tears down EVs, tears them down to just the cabin chassis. And we've been doing some deep diving into the makeup of these things, how they're built, how they're designed, what the internal plumbing really looks like in them. And you're right. They're completely different from the ICE vehicles, completely. I mean, some would even say it's not an electric vehicle, it's an electric device, right, on wheels. Because when you look at them, it's rather daunting when you see how they're being built and the sheer amount of electronics that are built into these units. So we went back and we entered in this relationship and we've been doing some discovery and we took our time on it to understand, if you're going to build a EV service contract and an extended warranty, you know, build it specific to the EV space. So instead of taking our traditional service contract and just putting some additional language into it for basic coverage. We expanded that. We went to a pure EV only service contract. But by doing that, we also took into consideration, you know, a lot of times the concern is my battery, right? You got the range anxiety, but what's going to happen when I have to replace that battery? Well, I think federally mandated 8100 is out there on most of these batteries and in excess of that in some instances. So looking at the way we adopted the coverage and we built it, we went into having a contract that has coverage without battery in case the buyer doesn't want that protection or in case they decide to keep it for less than 8 years or less than 100,000 miles. So we put a lot of thought into the coverage, but then we really took it a step further here internally and we started the process with our claims adjusters, you know, because one of the things that I've noticed is it's come at such a fast pace, the EV segment, right? And the projection and the hundreds of units in the years to come and the rapid pace of the way these vehicles are going to be coming to market and they're going to be delivered. But oftentimes, I think there's just a discomfort or an unfamiliarity with, A, how they're equipped, how they're built, but then potentially how they're going to be serviced through some of these dealerships. You know, there's a significant investment that dealers are being asked to make into their operation to position for the servicing of these vehicles down the road. So we took a look and we actually brought in and hired folks specifically for our EV claims area. So when we have calls routed into our system or into our call center, if it's an EV, it gets routed to EV specialists. So we have adjusters that are specifically on the EV side to have that expertise and in that knowledge to help support that experience, because there are quite a few complexities in relation to those vehicles. And then in addition to that, there's a lot of training that goes into it. We built web-based training for the F&I managers and sales representatives that they could leverage and use about what's different about an EV. But you know, big part of it as an industry that we're all facing is getting ourselves educated on these EVs quickly and finding the right folks that we can partner up with to educate ourselves for what's coming. Because you know, right now it's, what was it, 8%, I believe, was the latest I saw was the projected.
Yep. Yeah, so around 8%.
Yeah, around 8%, and I think they're projecting 24-25%
of market share.
Yeah, yeah, market share in the years to come. We have to hedge against that, right? As an industry, it's not going away. It's just a matter of how fast is it going to hit us.
Are there any non-obvious, right? The obvious risky component here is the battery. Most obvious, most expensive. But is there anything non-obvious? Because it seems at face value, like they don't have certain components that an ICE vehicle has, right? So maybe, obviously, you're not changing oil and whatnot. I mean, it's not like a normal vehicle. Could say that, hey, these are maybe cheaper to insure in the long term, right? Based on your data, right? What does the insurance look like? And I want to qualify that with one thing that, based on my understanding, from a maintenance perspective, right? Electric vehicles are actually more expensive, partly driven by the tires, right? So different type of maintenance, but net, tires they wear much, much, much quicker and those are expensive. But I want to understand from like a non-obvious insurable items, are there any major risks that you see based on your data with experience with EVs?
Sure. Yeah. It's a little early, right? They're in the infant stages with some of the EVs that have come to market, but you're going to find, I'll give you an example of one thing that stood out to us, because you've got motors in there that are very expensive. You've got converters. And again, you mentioned the battery, but the sheer volume of wiring harnesses that are in some of these. I mean, this facility we went to, the F-150 Lightning, had 5 times the amount of wiring harnesses than a traditional F-150, just to give you an idea. So, you know, those are components of it. There's a lot more underneath the hood, so to speak, than we're realizing, I think, at this point. Generally speaking, but I'll give you an example of something that stood out to us. So we've been covering EVs underneath a program we have dating back to 2017. Now, take that for granted. In 2017, we didn't have as many EVs out there, but there were still, you know, there were the Volts and the Leafs, and there were still vehicles out there that were electric. But I was looking at, okay, so what is a symptom, right? So we pulled some claims information and we're looking at it. And so living in Arizona, as we talked about early on out here, it's hot from April through October. Well, the number one thing that stood out as far as frequency of repairs, meaning the most common repair here in Arizona on electric vehicles, some would say, oh, it's got to be the battery. Well, it wasn't. It's the AC compressor. And so I thought about, well, why would the AC compressor be such a high risk out here in Arizona? And I'm walking with our claims manager and he said, well, let me show you. And we walked down into our parking garage And we've got a few, you know, there's a few Teslas here in the building, and they don't work for us though. They, you know, they're working with the attorney firm across the way, but we walked through the parking garage and he goes, "You hear that Tesla right there?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, that's the AC running to maintain a certain temperature to keep the battery cool to ensure efficiency on the battery." So, and they come to realize that often when it's 115 degrees out here in the summer months, June, July, and August, that these ACs are constantly running when these vehicles are parked outside when people aren't working. So it's significant uptick in just the AC compressors alone. So those are some of the downstream, you know, the effects.
That's definitely not obvious. So yeah.
No, and that's part of the findings that, you know, as an industry, we're gonna realize this down the road. And to your point earlier, are EVs gonna break less or more than ICEs? It's yet to be determined, right? They're completely different. And we need to get them into a segment where they start to age a little bit and we start to see, you know, a little bit more of the infrastructure nationally with more of these on the road. I mean, I think right now you got California, Washington, Oregon, and different parts of the country that are really, you know, the big producers on the EV side. They're picking up quite a bit out here in Arizona as well. But as it grows, we're all going to learn quite a bit more about the overall performance of these vehicles.
Mm-hmm. That's a very interesting insight. Do you find right now that like dealers are asking you a lot about this, or is there any common theme in types of questions that you're fielding from your dealer partners all over the country?
Not really a common theme. I think the common theme is directionally. You know, where are these going to be in the next few years? Because, you know, a couple of years ago, we were talking about is it's going to be 10, 15, 20, 25% of market share, and it's slowed down a little bit, and, you know, waiting for the demand to pick back up. We'll see. It's going to be interesting to see how it goes out. But I think the biggest thing that we've been finding is being able to get training to their personnel and to their teams for when these vehicles come in. And think about you take in an off make electric vehicle into your service department. So you take a Nissan Leaf, goes into your Ford dealership, and you're accustomed to only working off of maybe the Ford F-150 Lightning or the Mach-E, right? And now you've got to look up and work through what does it look like for a Nissan Leaf potentially in order to retain that customer, or do you sublet it out and send it elsewhere for the repair work? So, you know, learning on the back end how these are made and how these are built, because it just like we're seeing with the ICE segment, you know, a lot of it's just becoming pure replacement. There's not a lot of repairing going on anymore. A lot of it is just pure replacement on the components and the component groups. These full front end LED displays.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, I know. It's actually the worst, you know. With my experience in service, I mean, there's certain things. I mean, man, I remember like the Land Rovers. Like there was like one little thing broken, and I think we had like an Evoque or something. Like one tiny thing broken on the dash, and it's like, oh, got to replace the whole dash or something along these lines. I mean, I can give you a million examples.
Well, but yeah, we're seeing the same thing. We're seeing the same thing right now with all the touchscreens, and you've got folks that are pushing. It could be climate control. It could be the Bluetooth connectivity. It could be the radio. I mean, it could be a number of things. But bottom line is, it's being replaced. It's not like you can repair those. So
no. In many cases, you can't, and it's terrible because it just, you buy that car, and next thing you know, you're in it for another $2,000 on one component. So I think, you know, many of us have experience with that. All right, so Todd, just wrapping up, company's been around for 40 years. You've been there for 2 decades. I don't want to ask you what the next 20 years looks like. I don't want to go that far. But just thinking about the outlook here for the next couple of years, in light of where the industry's at, in light of all the changes that we're going through with affordability, consumer demand, right, inflation, what's your outlook for the next couple of years, and how does CNA play into that?
Well, I wish I had a crystal ball to give the insights. I mean, I wish I had it back in 2000, December of 2007, 2008, and 2009, when we went into the Great Recession, came out of that. But, you know, it's a resilient industry, period. And there's been ebbs and flows in just my short 2 decades in this business, but it'll continue. It's sustainable. It's just a matter of, you know, when you're doing things the right way and just focusing on the collective way the vehicles are being retailed. I mean, think about how cars are being sold today versus the way they were being sold, you know, 10 years ago. So what does the future of e-commerce or digital retailing look like? You know, it's speculative. Some people will say we're here, but we've been hearing that for years. And where does that go in the future, right? You've got the likes of the Carvana that we talked about a little earlier that's full e-commerce. So you've got the way the transactions will take place and the consumer's interaction with the dealerships. But long term, I think in the next, let's call 15 to 18 months, we'll see what Cox and others publish. We should see a nice uptick in the in once interest rates start to tick back. I've got a sense that there's a pent up demand out there. A lot of people, at least a lot of my friends and people in my Yeah, I mean, I've got a quite a few friends that are out there in the market right now that they're waiting, and they're waiting not just because of interest rates, but they're waiting for the right vehicle to come along. And so we'll start to see some of that natural attrition, like we see every we see these cycles in our business. And then, you know, on our end, on the F&I product related side, it's just looking at making sure that the products are designed correctly for the future of the business and the space. I mean, think about the rapid pace at which these things are being developed, the technology in them, the vehicles themselves. You know, when you write these contracts now, you've got to be more thoughtful and mindful about how they're being equipped. Putting an exclusionary contract out there and saying you're going to cover, you know, virtually anything and everything, need to hedge against that potentially and look at, you know, what are the right things to cover in relation to the vehicles? Because next year, there's going to be something new that an engineer in Detroit or elsewhere is going to come up with that's going to be put into one of these vehicles that no one would have foreseen coming. And then the year after that and the year after that. So there's going to, at the rapid pace is what's been amazing to me, that the industry is moving. On the engineering side of it, all the way on how the vehicles are moving from sales through F&I with all the systems and the back end. On the service end of it, with all the technology that's coming, and then brace ourselves for what's coming with AI, right? And with machine learning and some of the different technologies that have become available and that will continue to become available in our space to enhance the customer buying experience, but also the interaction from sales to F&I, to F&I to the consumer and fixed ops and all the way through the dealer operations. So it's exciting. I think we should be extremely excited as an industry on what's coming. Again, because it's a resilient industry and we will just continue to weather the storm and continue to work through what we're coming out of this COVID environment into the, I don't like the new norm when people say, oh, it's just the new norm. It's not the new norm. It's just a life cycle of our business that we've all learned how to adapt to and we'll continue to adapt. That's what we do.
Well said, Todd Sand. Thanks so much for coming on. Really enjoyed the conversation. We'll throw up the link in the show notes below if anyone wants to learn more about you and CNA. And again, appreciate it. Really enjoyed the conversation, Todd.
Yeah, thanks a bunch, Jose. Great being with you.
All right. Hope you enjoyed that episode. Please give the podcast a rating, consider subscribing to the show, and check the show notes for links to what we talked about. Thanks for tuning in. I'll see you guys next time.